All right, welcome back to Cold Blooded Conversations. I am your host, Nathan, and we are in part two of our discussion with world-renowned herpetologist, Mr. Romulus Whitaker. Last week, we discussed king cobras, Russell's vipers, and other snakes of the Indian region. But Rom, another species you are very familiar with and have done extensive research on is one of my favorite animals, the gharial. So why don't we talk a little bit about these very odd looking crocodilian?
Well, it's the crocodile from Mars. it just totally defeats your conception of what a croc should look like.
Yep.
But interestingly, if you look at the evolutionary history of crocodilians, the ancient ones of 30 and 40 million years ago were almost all long-snouted ones, and they probably ate small dinosaurs or fishy dinosaurs. The gharial is very unique, and the reason why I fell in love with it was, again, out of pure sympathy for it, because it was on the verge of extinction. I did surveys back in 1973, thanks to the World Wildlife Fund, which had just started in India. They gave me funds to survey some of the North Indian rivers where gharial were once quite common. If you read some of the old British hunting books, which are fascinating to read, they would say that the rivers are teeming with the long-snouted variety, or which obviously they're referring to the gharial compared to the mugger crocodile, which was the short-snouted variety. And they shot hundreds of them, if not thousands of them. But in 1973, I came out with a report, and I think I put a report in one of the American herp journals that there were probably less than 200 gharial left in the wild, adult gharial. And we don't know for sure, but that was the best estimate we could come up with. So I wasn't alone in this, this effort to conserve the gharial. The government of India soon caught on to the idea that we should do something about it. And something called Project Crocodile was started in 1975. And a consultant for the Food and Agriculture Organization by the name of Bob Bustard came over, and he started a program which really really changed the fate of the gharial. And that was to go out and collect eggs from the last nests that were being laid by the gharial on a certain couple of rivers in North India, and hatch the eggs in captivity, rear the babies to about 3 feet long when they're fairly stable, and then release them back to the wild. So now there are several thousand gharial left. It's still a critically endangered species, but the fact that going from a couple of hundred up to several thousands means that we've really managed to do something wonderful for the
and
creature.
I'm assuming they're protected as well.
Oh yeah, very strictly protected, even from then. The problem is people didn't look at the habitat as closely as they're looking at the species. So you can keep on releasing thousands of them out there, but if you're going to keep on damming the rivers and extracting water from the rivers and messing rivers up by something called the River Interlinking Project and ruining habitats, and sand mining. Yeah, there's just so many things against them, that you have to look at the habitat and create the space for these animals, not just hatch a whole bunch. Like we bred them in captivity for that purpose as well, to release them back in the wild. But that's not enough. You've got to get, the state governments very honestly and very hard working on protecting the habitat.
Wonderful. Now, another fun fact about them. Tell us about the huge bulbus on the nose. I find it fascinating what it's used for.
It is very interesting. It's called a ghara, G-H-A-R-A. And ghara actually in Hindi, the Hindi language, means a mud pot. Because it looks, and it's this big sometimes on some of those big 18-footers. So, we often wonder what the heck is going on with this thing. The fact is the ghara sits right on top of the nostrils of the gharial. And when the gharial makes blows air out of its nostrils forcefully, it's sort of sound, which sounds pretty crude, doesn't it? Yeah, like flatulence, you might say. But what it does is create this sound wave which goes right across the river and advertises the presence of the dominant male to keep other dominant males out of its territory and attract females. So it is actually a wonderful way of demonstrating who is who. I mean, who's king of the castle, so to speak. Also, I mean, in profile, you can very easily tell a male from a female gharial just by looking way across the river. You see this croc with a huge bump on its snout. And it's not
Male.
only us. I mean, crocs have, and gharial have very good eyesight. So the females are looking over and say, wow, he's a champ. I'm going to go over and, cozy up to him.
So, 1976, I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. So, what happened in 1976 involving not only the gharial, but the mugger and the salty?
But in 1974, I was married to a beautiful young lady called Zai Whitaker, my first wife, and she and I were working at the Madras Croc Snake Park, which I had set up in 1969, and we started breeding mugger crocodiles in captivity, and it was just amazing that they bred like rabbits. So we decided that we would, since crocodiles were having such a hard time, thanks to my surveys and other people's surveys around the country, we thought that creating a crocodile farm for breeding crocodiles and releasing the babies back to the wild was a classic idea. So in 1975, we bought a little piece of land along the coast south of the city of Chennai on the east coast of India. And luckily, the water table is a very, even though it's beach land, the freshwater table is very high. So we could just scrape, a few feet of sand out of the ground and you made a pool. And then we had to make a wall around it and put some crocodiles in there. And the mugger, which is our freshwater crocodile, started breeding. But then we realized that the gharial was probably the more important one. So we started collecting occasional gharial from one zoo or the other. And eventually we had a breeding group there and started breeding them in captivity. So the Madras Crocodile Bank opened in December 1976 to the public. And people were, sort of wondering how the heck we're going to support ourselves. Luckily, we did get help from the World Wildlife Fund and from some lo local industries helped us, people who were interested in conservation. But the main thing was tourism. So it became a very spectacular and well known tourist attraction with 500,000 visitors coming in there every year.
Beautiful.
And, each one person who came in bought a ticket and they'd bring their children, would have this wonderful experience of seeing crocodiles in captivity. Then we added lizards, then we added turtles and
And of course,
snakes
king cobras.
and king cobras, and that's where we started our king cobra breeding project. So yeah, it became, and it is one of the well, it's the largest reptile zoo in the region of the world, and it's doing very well.
So, are you still involved with them?
I'm still involved. I live far away from there right now. I live near a city called Mysore, which is also in South India. My son Nikhil is the director of research there. My ex-wife is the managing trustee there. So it's still a family affair. And yeah, it's my involvement as a trustee, of course. I give advice, not necessarily always wanted advice, but yeah. And so my visits there. Yeah, go
I'll
ahead.
definitely put a link to the Crocodile Bank and everything else we're talking about in the
Do
description
that.
so people can
Do
find you
that.
guys, so they can find your book, so they can find the articles we've referenced.
Good. Excellent.
So one thing I find just fascinating is how little we as humans know about animals and the world and ecology. I mean, just a few weeks ago, they announced a new species of Protobothrops that was just discovered. So we're in 2025, we're constantly finding new species, and you have actually found, are credited for finding a new species, Whitaker's boa. So
Well, I found it in the sense that when I found it, I thought it was an intergrade between the common sand boa and the red sand boa. But I'm not a taxonomist, and I don't go into, I do scale count and stuff like that, but I'm not a taxonomist by any stretch of the imagination. But a very dear colleague of mine, Dr. Indraneel Das, looked at it in more carefully, and he said, you've got a new species there. And
Wow.
he didn't tell me about it, but he said that he went and named it Eryx whittakeri. That, I don't know, in a way, I kind of object to naming things after people's names, because I think a snake should be named after, the habitat that it's found in, or maybe a descriptive name of, what it looks like. So, sorry, there's some traffic going by. I'm not sure if it interferes with what I'm saying,
Nope.
but interestingly, I did the same thing because my son Nikhil was snake hunting with us one day up in the hills of South India. He was 4 years old or 5 years old, and we weren't finding anything. And he turned over a couple of rocks, and suddenly he says, "Dada, snake, snake!" So we came running over, and I picked it up and looked at it, and it looked like a snake I have never seen before. And sure enough, it was a new species. It was a new species of kukri snake. And so we went. At that time, I was in touch with people at the British Museum who are specializing in the kukri snake and in this genus, Oligodon. And they said, "Yes, it's definitely a new species. Please write a description." So we described it as a new species and called it Oligodon nicolai, or Nikhil's kukri snake. So it's named after my son. So we're both
You're
got snakes
immortalized
named after.
forever. I
Yeah.
mean, as if your other accomplishments aren't going to keep you in the history books for hundreds and hundreds for centuries.
Well, I just wanted to make a mention that we came out with a book called Snakes of India, Ashok Captain and I, in 2004. And in 2004, we had the checklist of the snakes of India. There shows 275 species. Okay, since 2004, a lot of new species have been described. Again, thanks to all the very, very hardworking taxonomists. There are now over 350 species of snakes in India.
Wow.
And man, Ashok and I, along with a good friend of ours, Ganesh, are working on a new edition of Snakes of India for all 350 species. And that's a work in progress. I mean, the first book took us 10 years. I don't know
Wow.
how long the second book's going to take us.
So moving forward into the future, how can the next generation of reptile keepers and conservationists contribute to protecting these reptiles we love?
Well, when I sort of first started the Madras Snake Park in 1969, as far as India is concerned, there were very few people with a positive interest in snakes. People were scared of them, and people killed them. Things have developed amazingly positively since then. And, as you said very early in our conversation, people still have a very negative approach to snakes. The only good snake is a dead one, and that kind of stuff. But even those people are scared of them, or maybe hate them, they're still very interested in them. And it's very, very important for each one of us who are, and the stuff that you're doing, of course, is incredible. The stuff that we're trying to do at the Croc Bank in India, and the other zoos have you who have which have educational programs. The snake bite thing in India is very, very important. And anywhere in the world where snake bite is a problem, the only way we're going to get change people's attitudes is to do something about snake bite. And that is, of course, educating people, making sure they have access to antivenom. And everyone can contribute in some way or the other, either financially or educationally, to making things, positive things happen. Snakes are just naturally interesting. That's
Oh, yeah.
one very positive thing. And we have to use that and turn people onto that. When people do a snake rescue, which is happening a lot all over the world, including the United States, every rescue is an incredible opportunity for an educational, quick educational opportunity. And in India, when you when one of our guys like Ajay Giri, I'll send you a link to his king cobra captures in a place called Agumbe, where we have a rainforest research station. If you look at the links of what he does after he bags the king cobra, there's sometimes 100, even 200 people standing around just with their mouths and eyes wide open, seeing him
You know,
very
I've been dealing with
casually.
these animals for years and I'm still like that, so.
Well, I mean, they're just amazed at what he does, and he uses this opportunity as an educational opportunity. And that's what to do, is to get people to understand that snakes are here to stay. They're incredible. They're much better than cats at controlling rodents. And rodents are a very, very serious pest in many parts of the world, both for agriculture as well as human health. Think of the plague. It's just an incredibly good educational opportunity. Anytime you get a crowd of people around a snake, make it positive.
All right, let's bring up another one of my favorite Asian animals. Let's talk about the Komodo dragon.
What an animal. I mean, I would love to have a house pet as of a Komodo dragon. They're just so intelligent, and I'm not going to say loving because I don't know if that's the right word to use. But I mean, I've been to several places like the Taronga Park Zoo in Australia and several other zoos where they've kept raised the king the sorry the Komodo to be very friendly, and to when they're feeding it, there's a certain cue for them to feed, and a certain cue to when they're just being friendly with them. And they are just so intelligent, and it's really like having a dog around, It's just amazing.
The
I mean, what
local
they're capable of is something else. I mean, they could rip your head off,
Well, on
but
those
they
lines, I
don't.
remember Crocodile Hunter, one was chasing him and he ran up a tree and it got him in the boot and tore the leather. That was
Oh boy.
impressive. But back to the comment, kind of like a dog. They have a Komodo at the Greensboro Science Center, not too far from where I am, and they had a video, you know, they're just giving it a bath. I mean, how cool is that? And they're
It's
another
wonderful.
protected species. If I'm correct, all Komodo dragons are property of the Indonesian government, correct? Even when they're out of the country?
They said that at one stage, but now since they've been breeding them elsewhere, and we got our Komodo dragons at the Madras Crocodile Bank from the New York Zoo. So yeah, they're now. I mean, maybe the Indonesian government would like to think that, but of course, since they're breeding them all over the place, then it's no longer true.
So, what are some upcoming projects or discoveries that you are looking forward to and involved in?
Right now, I'm concentrating on the snake bite issue. And I think this has been something which I started back in the early 70s and haven't given up, but I've started getting more serious about it over the last couple of years since I'm 81. I'm not chasing king cobras much anymore. In fact, I think I sent you a video of my last king cobra, and that's kind of dramatizing it, but the fact is, when you get older, you're getting slower, and your reaction time isn't as good as it should be. So yeah, you should quit.
I mean, that it takes a very confident and mature person to say that, to recognize that, you know, I'm getting older, I'm not what I used to be, I could be putting myself or other people at risk by doing this still.
Or the snake at risk, if you're clumsy with it, you could hurt the snake. So, just be, wake up and smell the coffee,
All right, so what's one thing that you wish more people would understand about reptiles?
I mean, the whole conversation we've had just now always leads to the fact that, people, are more, akin to having furry animals as pets. I mean, of course,
I
cats
have a
are just
couple.
miniature. Cats are miniature tigers, and as long as you don't let them out in the yard to kill all the birds, I'm fine with that. Dogs are certainly the term man's best friend is a really good one, because We've got a couple of dogs, including one called a Belgian Malinois, which is
Oh.
just one of the most incredible dogs in the world, next to the Komodo dragon. So, yeah, I guess people have to just be aware that part of the wonderful creatures we have on Earth are this wonderful group called reptiles, and they're not out to get you.
No.
We are still the most dangerous animals in the world. I keep repeating that, and we just got to realize, and people should change the way they describe animals that like reptiles. They're not aggressive. They're defensive, and they're scared of us. And let's just try to change attitudes in what we do. I mean, people like yourself and our organizations are trying to do that, and I think we're making headway. I think we're doing pretty well. There's still a lot of things like rattlesnake roundups, which I greatly object to,
Oh.
and just killing massive numbers of snakes for nothing. But
I mean,
yeah, I think we're
I always dream of these stupid shows that I don't know how they actually get on television, where they go around just killing the alligators for the sake of killing alligators. I said,
yeah.
I can't wait until the day one of these clowns falls in and gets devoured.
Yeah, I know. I feel the same way.
All right, so before I hit you with one more question, is there anything else you want to discuss?
Well, I think we've gone through quite a bit, and why don't you go ahead and shoot?
All right. So, if someone wants to support reptile conservation, which is the way, what is the way for anyone to get involved?
I think just being there, being hung up and passionate about about what you do with reptiles. For example, a young lady from Canada just out of the blue sent us a song that she wrote about king cobras. And I thought, I mean, she says she's been fascinated with king cobras from the time she was 9 years old, and she doesn't know how or why. Then she's turned out to be a musician, and she's produced this wonderful song, which I'll send you it. And
If it's publicly available, I'll definitely post a link so everyone can hear it.
I don't think so yet. So let me find out from
Sure.
her how what the status of it is.
Great.
But I just think that there's lurking in everybody a
Yes.
sort of interest, a potential for interest in fascinating animals. And what could be more fascinating than reptiles? I mean, your tigers are great, pandas are great, but heck, a king cobra or a gharial, nothing like it.
So we started off talking about the book Snakes, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, only the
Yeah.
first third of your life. Phenomenal book. You will not regret buying it and reading it. So
Yeah,
definitely.
and posting a review of it what is it called?
Amazon. Amazon.
Amazon or yeah.
Five-star
Good.
reviews only.
Okay, and Goodreads.
Okay,
Yeah.
yep. I'll
That'll
post
help.
links
That'll
to
help
that.
a lot. Thanks very much.
And volumes 2 and 3 are in the works.
They are.
What a great time. This has been awesome. One of the all-time greatest herpetologists of all time, Mr. Romulus Whitaker. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'm sure, hopefully, this is the beginning of a nice, long, endearing friendship.
Thanks, Nathan. Wonderful, wonderful talking with you.
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to part two of our conversation with world-renowned herpetologist Mr. Romulus Whitaker. Make sure you go on to Amazon and purchase his book, be it paperback or Kindle, Snakes, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And remember, that is only the first third of his life. We have two more volumes coming at a date to be announced. Make sure you check out the links to see the videos and the articles and everything that we've mentioned in this episode. And there will be a full-length YouTube version incorporating videos that Rom has sent about all of the things that we've been talking about. So until next time, we'll see you later.